Bonjour, oui, oui, and welcome to the newest episode of Musings on Golf. In a little bit, you'll hear from Doug Ferguson, the award-winning national golf writer for the Associated Press. We're going to look ahead to a star-studded field at Pebble Beach this coming weekend for the AT&T. But Bob Bupka, the first Frenchman, Mathieu Pavon, to win on the PGA Tour. Congratulations to him. He won an event on the European Tour last year, got him his PGA card, and within the first month, bang, he's in the winner's circle.
And I thought he was the first Frenchman on Musings on Golf, but that was Kelly Elbin doing a Frenchman disguise. Very good there, Kelly. But it was exciting for France. You know, French people really love golf. I mean, the Ryder Cup was well attended when we were there. And, you know, they got the Olympics coming, which is going to be having golf next July Paris. So, you know, congratulations to Mr. Pavon on winning a nice win. And sorry to hear on the good news section, though, Kelly, about Terrell Hatton going to LIV Golf. I really formed quite an attachment with Terrell. He's a strange guy. You know, he's very vocal. He's very animated. And he's a tremendous golfer. But when I analyzed everything about the deal for LIV, I think Terrell probably made the right move.
I think he did too. What were the reports are, what, $60 million? Hey, Bob, look, it's all out of whack. If you look at the top line quarterbacks in the NFL, they're making in that $40 million range a year. But that's the NFL where 56 million people watch the AFC championship game, the NFC championship game. You can support that. Support $60 million for one player who really doesn't generate, honestly, that much interest. But why would he not take it, Bob? In all likelihood, if they get this agreement done at some point, those guys are going to come back into some form of a PGA Tour hybrid, kind of like Rahm. I don't blame him at all.
Yeah, and just to substantiate your figure about the NFL, if you want to go to Las Vegas next weekend and you want to watch the Super Bowl, as of today, minimum price for a ticket, $12,000. And if you want the premier package, they call it the Kelly Elbin package, $30,000.
I think that gets a private audience with me, which in and of itself might be worth a nickel. But, hey, we got an elevated event coming up this week. So at AT&T. Therefore, Bob, what? Rory, all the top players, Hovland, on and on, are there. It's a very different AT&T than what you and I have known for years. Amateurs will not be playing on the weekend. There won't be a cut. I just don't want to see a lot of this stuff. I get it with that you want to see the top players, but geez, Bob, give me a 36 hole cut. Give me a 54 hole cut. This is guaranteed money. I'm not a big fan.
Yeah, if top 50 players in the world are going to be playing there, 11 players have never played it at Pebble Beach, so it's going to have a completely different look to it. As you said, we're going to have to learn to live without Murray doing the stick out there, you know, with the gallery. Interesting proposition, I think. Rory's making his first U.S. start this year. Yep. Nick Dunlap is making his first professional start as a tour winner. Who's going to finish higher, Kelly Elbin? Rory or Nick Dunlap?
Rory's going to finish higher. I really like Hovland, though, this weekend. I think he tied for 11th last year at AT&T, Bob. Right now, it's kind of hard to bet against a guy who almost won in his first start in Dubai, then won for the fourth time in the event the following week. It's good to have him back on U.S. soil playing on the PGA Tour. I you know what? Hey, I missed it with Dunlap. I really thought he was going to stay at Alabama. Bob, again, it's kind of hard to pass up the opportunity to make a lot of money.
No, if you're good enough to win on the PGA Tour, you got to go out there and play, you know, because there's always that shadow with PGA Tour players, the shadow of injury, you know, it doesn't spare
you've mentioned
anybody.
That a lot. You've mentioned that a lot. That's a reality, isn't it?
That's reality. I mean, you want to swing away from your back going out, your wrist, your knee, whatever. And you know, if you're healthy and you want to get wealthy, certainly the place to go is the PGA Tour. LIV, by the way, starts their 2024 season at Maricopa in Mexico. Many thought that LIV would be long gone by now, but I think they're stronger than ever, and it's going to be interesting to see what finally comes down once a decision is reached between how much or how little cooperation there is between LIV and the PGA Tour.
That is still the great unknown, and they are stronger than ever. In addition to Tyrrell Hatton, they signed Caleb Surratt, who's a really good amateur player, sophomore at the University of Tennessee, who now turns professional, and he's on with Hatton on one of those teams. Yeah, Bob, that fog of uncertainty just lingers out there, doesn't it? This is our last show in January, January 30th, and still I don't get any feeling that they're any closer. In fact, players are leaving. They're poaching more guys, right, in the case of Hatton.
Yeah, well, let's go on to good news. You know, people want good news this time of the year. And
yes,
boy, is it good news that we were able to have Doug Ferguson. He's the lead writer for AP. We take it behind the scenes on a very difficult job. He's got to come up with a new line or, you know, a new focal point. He's one of the hardest workers out there, real good guy. And boy, it was a great interview on Musings on Golf. I guarantee you people are going to enjoy that one.
Always had a lot of respect for Doug, having, you know, done what I did at the PGA of America for a relatively short time, whereas Doug gets 30 plus years as the national golf writer for AP. It's a big responsibility, Bob. And as you note in there, one of the first ones, if not the first one in every day, right? And the last to leave. It's a huge responsibility. And as he talks about, with fewer and fewer media outlets covering golf, more and more falls on his shoulders to get the stories that you know, otherwise wouldn't be out there at all. He's really good.
Yeah. And you know the way it works, people may not be familiar with this, but AP provides a service, called golf coverage provided by Doug Ferguson. And newspapers all over the country, rather than send their own man out and try and develop their own story, they buy the service from AP, and that paper gets Doug's story. So he's probably read by more people in America than any other print outlet. And he's a good guy. He was a good friend. And it was an even better interview.
That was terrific. And you all will hear that terrific interview with Doug Ferguson, national golf writer for the Associated Press, right after this. William & Harry has launched a line of stylish waterproof golf shoes, and they are incredibly comfortable. The WH golf shoe is made of deerskin and suede. It has a gel insert, a form-fitting inner lining, and the reinforced hardened soft spikes on the outside of each shoe provide maximum performance. It's time to elevate your game. It's time to go to WilliamAndHarry.com.
Your most important shot is the one you're about to hit. And whether it's the first drive of the day, a difficult approach from a tight lie, or a bunker shot to save par, you need to know your golf ball will perform exactly the way you need it to. Superior performance on every type of shot. It's why the majority of the world's best players choose the Pro V1 or Pro V1X, and why you should too.
Welcome back to Musings on Golf. Bob, and our special guest today was named the recipient of the 2019 PGA of America Lifetime Achievement Award in Journalism. Then PGA President Susie Willie said of him, "Doug Ferguson may arguably hold the most demanding journalistic position in our sport. He is a golf fan's eyes and ears to what is happening on both sides of the gallery ropes. Since July of 1998, he has been the national golf writer for the Associated Press, and he's with us today. Doug Ferguson, welcome to Musings on Golf.
Thanks, Kelly. Bob, thanks for having me on.
You know, Doug, all I can say about you certainly are the hardest working guy in the media. And what do I base that evaluation on is the simple fact, for years, I would show up at the media room and there would be Doug Ferguson. I would be leaving the media room saying my goodbyes, and there would be Doug Ferguson. I mean, the passion that you put into doing your job, unequaled of anybody else I've ever seen in the golf media. And what's it like now to have covered the incredible shifts in professional golf over the last couple of years? I can imagine that it just hadn't been the fun that it used to be, Doug.
No, that's mostly because of the people around. And Bob, let's be honest, I was always there in the morning to beat you to the donuts. It's not always about the work. You know, I was thinking yesterday, just taking a long walk, mind was wandering. Things that feel like they happened 2 years ago were actually like 10, 15 years ago. There's a lot of time that's passed, and it never seems like things are better than they were. But when you talk about the coverage, you can look at the, you know, 20-year-old Tiger and what he was doing in Vegas and Disney when he started, the excitement he brought at the Masters. And you could talk about the each generation that would try to rise up to the challenge, and the rivalries he had with VJ and with Ernie, which I always thought were way more interesting than Phil. And where we are now, and then we shift over to a FedEx Cup system, and then a fall series, and now, you know, Saudi Arabia is getting involved, and all the things that are happening. To your point, Bob, is it as fun as it used to be? No, it's not. There's nothing really fun about it, but a big part of it, frankly, is what's happening to the media industry. Because even through all the changes, what kept it fun was the people you worked with week after week, and those numbers are shrinking. And it's frankly getting a little bit boring in the press room. Golf is still golf, and it's still great to cover. But, you know, a big part of our traveling circus is the circus, and it's got fewer animals, probably the best way to put it.
Now, you bring up a great point, Doug, because as the number of media dwindle, that little close-knit family that we operated under, I mean, it was work during the day, but we'd have many occasion to go out to dinner. We'd have many occasion even to play a round of golf. And now it's scary how few media are covering it in person. But I think it attributes a lot, obviously, to the internet, where, you know, you can sit at home. You can't get exactly the same as you could get at the event, but you could get enough to make believe to put together a good story.
We had two incidents in Hawaii that I thought was pretty fascinating. One was opening round at Kapalua. Justin Rose is playing with Taylor Moore, and Justin switched to a different ball, and then he wound up hitting the wrong ball and got penalized for it, and he made like a 7 or 8 on the hole, whatever. So something got lost in translation from the ground to Golf Channel. And then to your point, Bob, people are at home writing off what they hear on television and got the story entirely wrong and presented it in such a way that next time Taylor Moore switches golf balls, you know, he needs to be a professional and let Justin Rose know about it so this stuff doesn't happen. Complete opposite is what happened. And it's all because there was a little bit of miscommunication, which happens, but somebody is sitting at home watching off TV. Next week at the Sony, we have a kid, Carl Yuan, I think that's how you pronounce his name, hits his final shot onto the 18th. It descends into the grandstand tenant area, and they never found it. And they brought the officials in, they interviewed people, and they found out that, or they came to the conclusion that the ball was lost in a temporary movable obstruction area, and he was given relief as if the ball had been found. Kind of unusual. It does happen. And the internet was filled with stories about how the ball was in the hospitality tent. How can they not find it? Why is the PGA Tour going soft? All based on what they saw on television. And if you got back there, you would see that little tented grandstand behind it were 8 separate tents, 2 trailer freezers, 30 golf carts, cables running everywhere, mesh tinning everywhere. It's a jungle back there. That was the complex, not the tent. But you're sitting at home watching on TV. Somebody writes it. Someone else better. I better write the same thing. So they write the same thing. And pretty much everybody got it wrong. That's our life. Not always, but that's the danger of just sitting at home. The other danger being that you never, you know, frankly, a lot of people don't get a chance to look somebody in the eye. Yeah. Right, what you want. You'll never go to the locker room, as they used to say way back in the day.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the downfall I felt really originated when it was decided that, well, you don't have to come into the media room. We'll do it at the 18th green. Then one player did it at the 18th green. Then the other players started saying, hey, if he doesn't have to go in the media room, I don't want to go in the media room. And I thought that was, just not being able to get the job done. Because when they came in the media room, they were sitting down, they were focused, and you had your choice of questions to ask. And, yelling a question out when you're behind the 18th green, I just didn't think was a very professional way of getting it done.
No, and it's still not. You kind of wish Jack were 40, and were around today and could kind of lead these people on how it's done. But look, the tour enables it. They're the ones that's probably culpable as anybody. You'll have interviews before the tournament begins in the press room, which now they're bringing them actually into the press room to avoid building a interview area, which is fine because those things get costly. That thing will not be used again until Sunday. And the reason they can't bring them in on the weekend is because they have the tour's own video camera set for their own website and everything else stationed out there on 18, and it's too much trouble to bring it in. Who suffers? We do. I would tell you from a personal standpoint, Bob, on Saturday, and you know this, we get to the last shot on Saturday, and I'm going to have something out within the next 10 or 15 minutes. I don't have time to go all the way back out to 18 for these interviews, which is okay. I'm used to that. We used to have a lot of people pick up the slack and ask the questions, and now we got maybe one or two people, and you come back and here's this transcript and there's nothing on it. I mean, this is a real simple formula I'm about to share, but there's no good answers unless there's questions. So transcripts are great, but there has to be questions to be answers. You know that, Bob, in all your work. And so that's, to me, that's what's hurt a little bit of the storytelling from the lack of the of a full media contingent that we used to have. And I don't care who they are, by the way. There's people who do nothing but podcasts or blogs who don't get out much. There's room for everybody in here, but there's just so few people on the road anymore.
Yeah, it's really sad situation. Something that's not sad, though, I understand that your dad, Brad, had a lot to do with you getting your first taste of golf as a kid. Share that with us, Doug.
Yeah, he played played at La Jolla High School with Phil Rogers. I mean, the varsity as a freshman. So golf has been in his blood since he could walk probably. And just he just passed it along to the rest of us. I still have these memories as a kid. My dad worked in retail 6 days a week, and his one day off was Thursday. And he was always playing golf that day. That was his day off to go to this place. I think it was called Green River, somewhere in Southern Cal. And then taking a nap on the couch in the afternoon. But my grandfather was one of the charter members at La Jolla. And it's been in the family. But those were some great times. He taught me a ton about the game. Even when I started covering golf for the AP, he would just point out some of the trends, some of the people he liked, some of the ones he liked watching. And, to me, Bob, one of the more interesting moments was when I think it had hip replacement, but he wasn't moving around all that great. Took him to Harding Park for the match play that one year it was there. And he couldn't get around much. So he sat up in the grandstands behind the first tee. And when we got back together later that day, he said they all swing it the same way. And from his eyes, it was a really interesting viewpoint about what technology, coaching, modernization of the game was doing. There were no individual swings. You couldn't sit there and say, look at how this guy moves through the ball and he's different from this guy. They all launched it the same way, high and far, reducing spin. And I thought that was pretty fascinating.
I've heard over the years, I've never asked you directly, but you on the news side as a reporter quite a while before turning to golf. Was that a decision you made? Did you request going to golf? Did AP say, Doug, we want you to go to golf? How'd that come about?
That was kind of weird. I always wanted sports when I started with the AP, but those jobs were few and far between. I mean, you really had to wait your turn for something to open. So I'd done news in Oklahoma City and then took over the Tulsa office. And really, Bob, it was all about when they moved the PGA from Oak Tree in 1994. They had some ownership bankruptcy issues. They moved it to Southern Hills, which is where I was living. And my buddy and mentor in Oklahoma City reached out to Ron Syrak, who was my predecessor, and asked if I could come along and be part of the coverage team. So my relationship with Ron started there. And then Ron used me a couple more times. And then when he moved on to Golf World, by that point, I'd found an opening in Jacksonville doing sports, the Jags, the Gators, what have you, and just kind of moved into the role. So I would call it a complete fluke. I used to tell people that I got into golf by bankruptcy. if Landmark hadn't gone into bankruptcy, I might not have gone down to Oak Tree. So that's how it started.
Really funny how the twists and turns that we go through during our lifetime.
I agree.
Well, it's been golf's gain for sure. 110 major championships that Doug Ferguson has covered, 13 Ryder Cups. July of 98 is when you succeeded Ron as the lead, as the national golf writer. Like, even with your experience, Doug, in news and so forth, it's a big responsibility all of a sudden. You're the national guy for a sport that Tiger is just coming on. It's becoming bigger and bigger.
It is. I used to always think, and I would tell people that I would write as if nobody was reading. Don't worry about what people are thinking about it. Write what you see. Write what needs to be written. Tell whatever stories need to be told. And that carried me through. I think it's funny, Kelly, especially from an Associated Press standpoint, they used to call us the anonymous press. I mean, way, way, way back in the day, somebody like Bob Green, who did this for many years, you know, he's in Greensboro covering the tournament. Whatever story he writes, Greensboro's got its own paper. Raleigh's got its own. I mean, all the papers in Carolina are using their own writers. And so everybody at the tournament has no idea what Bob is reading is writing. But they are in Dallas, Boston, Chicago, Billings, Montana, wherever else we reach, you know, a lot of people.
Under that AP header, not necessarily his name, just the AP header, right?
Yeah, they could. Yeah, they had a policy where if it was tucked inside, the name would be stripped, and that's fine. That's what we grew up with, got used to. And then, kind of when the internet came along, it just, you know, now you are in every site, whether people are going to it. You know, I never know who's reading. I just know what's out there. But it just added a different dimension to it. And now I tell people just the opposite. And I think it's still a good policy to write as if no one's reading, because it will free you up to do what's right. Now there's another part of it, which is reading. Whoever you're writing about, act as if they're reading it so that you can be able to face them the next day. And look, 90% of what we do is happy stuff. You know, guy just shot 64. Guy just won a tournament. This is good news. Who was it? Grayson Murray, when he won it at Sony, and he's had his let's call it behavioral issues over the years and relationship issues, whatever you want to call them. And Grayson said he just doesn't read anymore. And I told him, well, you go ahead and read this stuff, because it's, you know, you just want a tournament. It's usually going to be pretty good. Give a week and the press will rip him again. Who knows? But yeah, be able to see a guy the next day. And so there's a lot that goes into that.
The outset of our talk, you talked a lot about the diminishing number of media covering golf, and you've seen, and we've all seen just in the last quarter century, massive changes in communication. I'm wondering if you could sort of give our listeners a day in the life for you covering an event, let's say a major golf championship in 1998, what you were asked to do versus a major golf championship that you covered in 2023.
You know, we used to, I did get there early. Sometimes it was for the donuts, whether Bob was there or not, full disclosure. I would get there early, you know, when I started, usually around 6:30 or so, and would be out on the range, on the putting green, just eyes open, paying attention. Would usually go out and walk 9 or 18 in the morning. I would write a little story, wait for the guys in the afternoon to finish, write that up, do kind of the wrap-up story, and there you have it. So now, not much has changed in terms of hours. It's probably a little bit earlier, because as soon as we get going, we're having to write this running, you know, I don't know if blog is the right word. We call it maybe live updates that have to be updated every, you know, hour and a half. So instead of walking the full morning, sometimes I'm caught coming back in and making sure that's going on. There's so many items that are sensitive to the nowness of our business. There's probably less time on the golf course than there used to be. I used to spend a lot of time on the golf course because that's where I thought all the action took place. I think it still is, by the way. What I find interesting is all the majors in at least 2023 and maybe 2022 as well, I did not set foot on the golf course until the opening round. And that's what I think that's more than anything what's changed. Why it's changed, I'm not really sure. I haven't given that much thought. I just kind of do what I got to do. But it kind of annoys me because I think some of those practice days and frankly, pro-am days at tour events are the most valuable. And I think more than anything, they keep bringing in more players and there's less people in the press room to ask questions and you feel a little bit of a responsibility not to leave the guy hanging. I think that might be it too. Still, by the way, if it sounds like I'm starting to dig ditches, please don't take that the wrong way. I still love going to the course every day. Right. I love what we do every day, but there are changes that are just different.
What's a typical week like for you in terms of when you get to an event? And then do you, when the event's over on a Sunday night, do you fly out? I mean, you had to rack up many, many thousands of miles last year. Is there a routine in terms of end of one event, start of another, travel this day, arrive this day?
I'm finding shortcuts as I get older, Kelly, but it's usually show up on Monday on the West Coast and some of the bigger events like Memorial. That's always a little bit different. You want to be there a day early. But the rest of them, it's usually a Tuesday through Sunday and get going Sunday night if you can. Usually it's Monday morning and on to the next one. But here, for example, and it's a money saver and it's a travel saver. I've been coming to Hawaii, staying for a couple of weeks after, and instead of flying home to Florida, back out to California, I'll just go to Pebble. I'll stay in my home state for an extra week, head to LA, and that's just one plane trip. Florida, you know, I think when I get home after LA, I don't think I'll be on a plane again until the PGA. And so driving when you can, we're all part of the circus. I remember a conversation I had with Mickelson. This is probably, I think I said earlier on, I lose track of time. So whenever this was, Phil and I were chatting outside the putting green at Memorial. And he was asking about my schedule. And I think, I mean, he probably knew this, but it was a real light bulb coming on moment that we basically do the same things he does. We're just not quite as good as golf. We're not quite as rich. And we fly coach. That's the big deal. And we have a courtesy car waiting for, I could go on and on about that, but you know, I always appreciate the players who look at not just the media, but look at all aspects of tour, whether it's caddies, whether it's equipment reps or the media or the guys holding the boom mic. We're all traveling. We're all having to deal with airports and whether the bags are going to get lost in the whole nine yards, just like they are. We're not part of the show like they are, but we contribute to it and all part of the circus.
Doug, I got to ask you about Tiger Woods. Obviously, I know firsthand that you have a excellent relationship with him. He respects you, and that's all you can hope for. I know covering Tiger was different. I've been blessed to have covered all 15 of his majors, which meant that I came along in the right time. What was it like for you on covering Tiger? How did you find him?
That's a great point, Bob. I'm thinking that as you're asking the question, and I think it was a lot funner now looking back than it was then. And what I mean by that is, in the middle of it, I mean, it was so much so fast that it was almost day to day, and it was pretty hard to step back in the middle of it and say, "Holy cow, what do we have our hands on?" I mean, you knew it because you were writing it and you were talking about it and you were televising it in the whole nine yards, but. But it's very much like his career now. When you look back, it almost makes it more special because you're seeing it from, you know, almost from your rearview mirror instead of right outside your windshield. But it was pretty phenomenal. I don't spend as much time with Tiger as I do now, even when he is out playing. But back then, I always remember he wasn't the best interview. That doesn't mean he was a bad interview. Some people have it and some don't, and he was just okay. But because he was doing so many incredible things and you had to write about him every week, I had to go find something else to see, something fresh, something new. Oh, so it must have been, I don't know, 4 or 5 years of getting to the course by 5:30, 6 in the morning, going practice rounds with him, pro-am rounds, whatever the case may be, just to see something that might allow me to write something different. And from there, we developed a pretty good relationship. I spent probably more time with him at pro-ams than any other player. And it was great fun. We had some unbelievable conversations. None of it was for print. That doesn't mean it was completely off the record. It was just people talking golf. And that was kind of to me, the genius of Tiger. For all he does and all the star power he brings, he's still a golf geek and he loves talking about the game. And that was fun.
I know one thing that, I grew to detest. Tiger became the original walk and talk interview. And I have enough trouble talking standing still, trying to walk and talk with everybody trying to talk to Tiger at the same time was not that easy. Matter of fact, I see a lot of video, Doug, of me jumping over a fence or climbing up a stairwell. I mean... anything just to get next to Tiger. But that's what you had to do if you wanted Tiger Woods.
Yeah, it's true. It was so rare to catch him off to the side in the locker room. Always difficult. But that's Tiger. It's funny on the walk and talk too, Bob. I was thinking of Dustin Johnson, actually, who's a delight. I really enjoy talking to Dustin when I see him, but he's always in a hurry too. He's always got one foot out the door. It feels that way. And I needed him for probably 4 minutes. And he said, "Can we walk and talk?" And I said, "No, we're going to stand right here and I'll be 4 minutes." And I'm telling you, he locked those eyes dead into mine and gave it all his effort. We're talking about technology. I know the fact that I'm talking technology with Dustin sounds funny in itself, but he was really good. And he was done. And then he turned and was gone in a heartbeat. And I looked down and my recorder had like 3 minutes and 58 seconds. It was beautiful. You guys love
exactly
to do that.
Can exactly we walk what home? You needed, right?
Exactly.
Hey, have there been, there have to have been, we talked a lot about Tiger, have to have been favorite special moments, whether it's a tournament or people for you over time. Has there been one major championship that stood out? Has it been one you mentioned about that interview with Dustin, or one person or individuals who you've really enjoyed talking with and have developed relationships with?
I enjoyed the time. I regret to go back to what Bob said a minute ago. I mean, the one thing that we're lucky about is having to spend an entire career with Tiger. For those who never saw Willie Mays, for those who didn't get to see Jim Brown run, who missed Bill Russell or Wilt Chamberlain or Gretzky or go on and on. You know, we got a front row seat to that, and that was pretty special. I miss Nicklaus as a great example. I mean, I picked up Jack for the first time in probably 1990, I'm going to say 4, 95. But I really enjoyed talking to Jack when we were at the Honda, the Memorial. I loved being in Arnold's office more than anything. I think that was as great a privilege as anything I've been around, and I kind of enjoyed those times with Tiger, and I'm talking about probably 02 through probably 09, through kind of the personal life falling apart, and then that changed a lot of things, but It was fun. It was just golf. It was a good insight to see what these guys think of off the course, how their mind works, and how much they love golf. We forget that sometimes. I mean, it is such a kind of a, I don't know if gossipy is the right word, but this is our kind of our media, not just golf and sports, but everywhere of reaction and short shelf life and whatever. And it's good to just get back to the very core of what we're talking about in the first place. I didn't really answer that question, Kelly. I couldn't.
No, that's
think.
Okay. Any,
there's was so there, many good moments.
But yeah, was there? I mean, off the top of my head, when he chipped in off the green on 16 at the Masters to win, the moments like that. Is there one that you were like, oh my God, this was the pinnacle for in terms of what I could cover?
I always honestly, I think, and a lot of those, and it goes back to my very job. I mean, you talk about Augusta in 05. Some of the dramatic finishes he's had, the putt he made at Torrey Pines in 2008. I'm sitting in the press room and I've got, you know, especially at a major, I've got like 5 minutes to get a lead out. So that's been the one regret about this job is I've never been able to be there on 18, to be there, you know, on the 16th, at Augusta, because I'm having to, you know, I can't be two places at once type thing, and nothing breaks my heart more than to sit there and listen to my colleagues who can't keep their mouth shut because they come back into the press room and they're like, oh my God, that was awesome. And I'm like, yeah, well, I couldn't be out there for it. McCabe used to kill it. Jim McCabe was the Boston Globe and then Golf Week. He just said, oh man, I just spent such and such doing this. And I'm like, yeah, I had to get a lead out. Couldn't help you there. Ron Krojcik from the San Francisco Chronicle.
Good man.
God bless him. I wanted to kill him. Obviously being 3 hours behind too, and him having a completely different role, terrific writer. When Tiger made that chip, and you mentioned to Kelly, he came back and was telling me what it sounded like. And I was just absolutely dying, but I was really happy for him. I mean, and they had left actually the 16th when they saw that Tiger was in trouble, and they said, you know what, this is going down to 18. Let's get up to that little press tower they used to have at the 18th green. And as they were, you know, crossing the 17th fairway, they could hear the crescendo of a cheer and then a drop and then an explosion, and just listening to the crowd almost illustrated the entire shot. And I loved hearing that story from him. Kind of reminded me of, you know, the more times you spend at Augusta. And I think you both can relate to that. You can almost hear what's happening by the cheer, by where it's coming from.
Well, it's the ultimate theater, right, Doug?
Oh, it's completely. So I was with, I think one of the cooler moments as it relates to noise, and I think noise is very undervalued in golf, was the year that Schwartzel ended up winning, but Tiger got off to a real heater at the start, and we were everywhere. And I, you know, we had Schwartzel chipping in on one and holding out on three and Adam Scott doing this, and here's Tiger on the right. It was just too many cheers. And we said, we got to get back in, you know, watch this on TV. We won't be able to keep up. So we're waiting to cross the eighth fairway, and all of a sudden it was a ground shaker of a roar, and I said, "That's Eagle." You know, the eighth goes up the hill, you can't see the green. I said, "That's a three," and it was a big three, meaning it probably came from someone big. And the marshal said, "Tiger just came through a minute ago," and I said, "There you go. That's a Tiger Eagle right there," which it was. That wasn't the best part, as we're still waiting for the next group to. You know, pass on the eighth, so we could cross the fairway. There was another big cheer down by 11 green, and then you heard another huge cheer about 5 seconds later, and that was down by, you know, 14 tee, and then another one from a different part of the course. And I turned to our columnist and I said, "They're posting Tiger's score, because the three that Tiger made at number eight at that point tied him for the lead." Now the leaders, you know, still were early on the front nine, but every time they posted Tiger tied for the lead, you got a cheer from different parts of the golf course. And that was hair raising.
That also was one of the really cool things about the Masters. You can't have phones, so you don't have that immediacy that you have virtually every other event.
Yeah, that's right. And the people, you know, I've known people who've gone there for the first time, and I wonder how they're going to do it without their, you know, without their lifeline in their phone or in the pocket. And they all say it was fine. Loved it. It was great. It was great not having it. And you know what, from a, from a media coverage perspective, this goes back 20 years. I can remember being at the Solheim Cup at Barca back in Sweden, 2003. And I mean, no respect to the coverage, but I'm sitting there watching on TV and I thought to myself, did I come all the way over to Sweden to have Golf Channel bring me the Solheim Cup? No, I'm here for a reason. So boom, I just headed out to the golf course and found that day that you can see without seeing. I mean, you could be with a group, you could hear a cheer, you could look at a board, you could understand what it probably meant, catch up with someone else who tells you. And there's just no beating the atmosphere. I don't know what golf looks like on TV. I don't watch it a lot. I actually do, you know, on a Sunday afternoon over the last 2 hours. But being on the course is just magic, especially Augusta.
Let me ask you this, Doug. I think I qualify for the biggest comeback of any media person that covered the Masters. I go back to 1986, my first Masters. Basically, I'm there to get the reaction of the players that are going to come to Shinnecock, which is in my backyard, for the U.S. Open. Jack finishes his round, and I wait. You know, I was a rookie. I didn't step on any toes. Finally, I had the courage to approach him, and I said, Mr. Nicklaus, I'd like to ask you a question. He said, what is it? I said, I'd like you to tell me what you think of the U.S. Open coming to Shinnecock in June. And he goes, U.S. Open? I'm here to win the Masters. You want to talk about the U.S. Open? I said, thank you, Mr. Nicklaus, and I walked away. And he became a good friend after that. But boy, oh boy, what a rude awakening to the Masters for me.
It's a lesson big time learned, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. But I certainly share Doug's sentiment. If we had Jack Nicklaus to interview on a weekly basis, boy, people would be doing the job for free, I would bet.
Yeah, it really, really set the tone. And there's good people out there. I think there's great people out there. You feel like this modern times that we're in, a lot of them have so many other avenues to talk. And that was, you know, it was kind of scary at first for most newspaper people when the Players Tribune, you know, when that came out, and all of a sudden, and then you've got X and all the different social media platforms. It gave the players a chance to speak directly to their fans and not have to go through the media. That's one way to look at it. And look, I don't know that the media has really held its head high with some of the things that have been done and written over the years. Maybe that's the best way to go. So now if someone is becoming a media star, instead of being a great interview on television or radio or print, they can be cheeky and funny on X or on Instagram and get just as much value. I think Max Homa is a great example of that. I think really highly of Max. I think he's better on social media sometimes than he is in the interview. Sometimes I feel like every question he answers, he's on a podcast. But Max, what comes through and makes him so fascinating to me is that he is really good at social media and communicating without even trying. And he's really good at golf because he tries super hard. And sometimes it's easy to not see the part about how hard he works at his craft. But the messaging is really fascinating to me. But on the other hand, you know, you still need the media, as harsh as they can be. Times that they miss things, frankly, they all make mistakes as well. Can you know, when you get somebody like a DeChambeau or a Bubba, who just goes straight to their people, they don't need the media. They're also feeding them a bunch of crap. And sometimes you need the media there to call them on it. That would be the one value of what we've got left that keeps players to go from direct to fans. And you know what? Sometimes the fans may love that. Don't know. Our job is just try to report and entertain and interpret and just give it the best truth you can.
I have two questions left from me. Hey, Doug, number one, your dream foursome, if you would. Three players who would round out your dream foursome, whether alive or deceased.
Well, my dad would be one. Julie Inkster would be one. along with my dad. And if we were to do a Grant Thornton Invitational one, what would I do there? I would probably take Mickey Wright. How about that?
How about that? Why those two?
I could come up with 100 more, Kelly. That's I didn't so unfair expect to that it. Question.
No, but why Julie? That's because Julie was on our show. She was great. She was fabulous. Yeah. Why Julie?
I've had a connection with Julie since I went to that first women's open she won. She's almost been like a big sister to me through the years, but I just find her to be a riot. I find her to be a great player, great company, remarkable too. I mean, as I said, Julie Inkster would be one, along with my dad. And if we were to do a Grant Thornton Invitational one, what would I do there? I would probably take Mickey Wright. How about that?
About that, why those two?
I could come up with 100 more, Kelly. That's I didn't so expect that question.
No, but why Julie? That's because Julie was on our show. She was great. She was fabulous. Yeah. Why Julie?
I've had a connection with Julie since I went to that first women's open she won. She's almost been like a big sister to me through the years, but I just find her to be a riot. I find her to be a great player, great company, remarkable too. I mean, I've known Julie forever, but I still think one of the most underreported things in this game is the fact that you could grow up on the 14th fairway at Pasatiempo and nobody in the house plays golf. So that's pretty amazing. Secondly, that you could not pick up a club until you're 15 years old and 5 years later be the U.S. Women's Amateur Champion is staggering. She's great fun. Mickey Wright has always been a bit of a mystique. That was one of the best, most honored interviews I've ever had in my life, was getting on the phone with Mickey Wright because she was so hard to reach. The late Rhonda Glenn and Barbara Romack helped make that happen. A lot of it had to do with her collection going to the USGA. But I mean, this is the single, to me, and I'm not a big greatest guy, but I don't think there's been a greater player in the history of women's golf than Mickey Wright. It's not even... You can make a case, I think, for Louise and Babe, but you know, when Hogan says it's one of the best swings he ever saw, you stand up and take notice, and so that would be a dream there. And then just my dad from getting into the game, and I've played plenty with my dad already. He enjoyed it so much. I'll never forget, we played Kapalua one year, and he said after that day, he said, "This is the greatest day of golf I've ever had in my life." And I'm thinking to myself, Dad, you grew up in La Jolla Country Club. You've played Pebble Beach. You've competed all the way through high school. It's some pretty, I appreciate the moment, but come on, that's a pretty good golfing life too.
As I say goodbye, Doug, I'm a little bit surprised that you didn't select, and I thought for sure you were going to say that you would like Alex Maselli in your foursome.
I would almost pick Alex just to watch a guy use a putter from 140 yards away in a snuggy fairway uphill.
That's Alex.
He's a great friend.
Well, Doug, close it out, please. As a great storyteller, please tell the story of the beautiful ring you received as the Lifetime Achievement Award recipient that was then lost, and then tell that, please.
Yeah, so I always wore it, and when I put things on, I don't take them off, basically. And we're at the beach, and my wife has asked me, you know, why, you know, you're going to lose that. Why do you not leave it at home? So I went ahead and took it off and put it in the little back pocket of the chair. And because this is something I've never done before, at the end of the day, as I go to pick up the beach chairs, it must have fallen out. I don't realize it's gone until 3 or 4 hours later we get home. And figured it's gone forever. So I didn't have the heart to tell Julius Mason. I always have dinner with Julius at the British, and didn't have the heart to tell him I lost the ring. I felt like such an idiot. And fast forward, my wife and I are having breakfast, and I get this message on Facebook from a woman who lives probably an hour away from the beach. Her and her husband don't go very often, and they're at the beach, and they're looking around, and as they're leaving, they see this kind of a flash. You know, the sun hits it sticking through the sand and makes her look, and she pulls it out, and it's this ring. And she has no idea where it came from, but she reads what it says. She reads the inscription, had my name on it in the inside. And then she goes on the internet and just starts searching, and found me and found my Facebook page and sent me a message, and there it was. So there is the eye in the, or the needle in the haystack.
Yeah.
And there's the ring in the sand that I'm not sure which was more impressive, but it was pretty wild.
What a thrill to get that back, huh?
Yeah, it really was. And now it's in a trophy case, by the way.
Not to the beach anymore.
In this shadow box of the whole nine yards. And I got to take the glass out if I'm going to wear it.
Bob, please send off our friend, would you?
It's very difficult to put into words. What a pleasure it's been, Doug. You've been respected and admired for many a year for the job you do. You give it your best, and people all over the world have benefited from the talent you possess to take your thoughts and put them down on paper. Thanks for being with us on Musings on Golf. For Kelly Elbin, trust me, my friend, you have been a real pleasure, and I know our listeners are going to enjoy hearing what you had to say.
Just like you, I want to look good and perform at my best on the golf course, and that's exactly why I wear the new WH golf shoes from William & Harry. I love these golf shoes. They're made of deerskin and suede with a soft gel insert, and the reinforced hardened soft spikes increase stability and balance, and they are so incredibly comfortable. I invite you to head on over to williamandharry.com to check out the new WH golf shoe. Look your best and play your best with William & Harry. Yeah, you know, I know how important that was for Doug to have Lady Luck shining on him and have that ring be found. It meant a lot to him. He's a guy with a lot of pride. He was a newsman before, so he's got that investigative side. I'm going to dig in and find those details, and for somebody to find something that he had misplaced that meant so much to him was a nice way to wrap up our interview.
Yeah, and what Kelly's referring to, you heard it during the interview, Doug Ferguson inadvertently had his ring that he got from the PGA of America fall off at the beach. And you would think, well, that's gone forever. But some lady found it, saw his name inside of it, made the arrangements, and he got it back. Couldn't happen to a nicer guy. And speaking of nicer guys, what a guest we have coming up next week. I've known him for a long time. I worked with him. I worked with his son. His name is legendary in the broadcast business. His name is Jay Randolph Sr., and I can go way out on that limb and say our listeners are really going to enjoy that edition of Musings on Golf with none other, the one and only Jay Randolph Jr.
With that terrific voice that's so...
The one, the only Jay Randolph Sr.
With that voice that was known for years on his time at NBC Sports. And it's not exaggerating to call him legendary, to call him a pioneer. And the stories that you're going to hear, you will thoroughly enjoy. We thank Doug Ferguson again for joining us. Jay Randolph Sr. next week. As for now, au revoir. Kelly Elbin signing off for my good friend Bob Bubka, Musings on Golf.